Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Your daily encouragement that God has the world in the hollow of his hand. This is Mornings with Carmen LaBurge on Faith Radio. If we're gonna fly, we fly like eagles. Arms out wide. If we're gonna fear, we fear no evil. We will rise. By your power, we will go. By your spirit, we are bold. If we're gonna stand, we stand as giants. If we're gonna walk, we walk as lions.
Good morning on this Friday, May the 6th, 2022. Good morning, good morning, good morning. It's time to rise and shine. So among the headlines of the day, we continue to follow the story of the Supreme Court leak and, you know, the whodunit related to that. I suspect that as news unfolds, as that investigation continues and news comes forward, you know, that it's possible we'll learn something more over this weekend. So I want you to be, I think positively prepared to talk about the abortion debate, the conversation about Roe v. Wade, how it was decided, whether or not it was a good decision from a pro-life position. I obviously think that the Roe v. Wade decision made in 1973 by the then justices of the Supreme Court was not a positive, not a good, not a social good, in fact, a social ill. And so, I would positively anticipate a reversal of the Roe decision by the current justices of the Supreme Court. Now, having said that, we don't actually know what they're going to do. What we have is a leaked opinion in its early form from February. We expect to hear from the court in June. And so we don't actually know what the Supreme Court is going to issue in terms of a ruling in the Dobbs case, which is the case currently pending before them that is at issue. But we have a draft opinion written originally by Justice Alito, and the response to that across the country, certainly by the media and by abortion advocates and by politicians interested in abortion advocacy, has been energetic. I'll use that word. So let's talk about what's in front of us today in relationship to this. There is a website called Ruth Sent Us. It's named after the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And on that website, there are these announced plans for a, quote, walk by Wednesday, next Wednesday, at the homes of six conservative justices of the Supreme Court. The idea is that, you know, they could be bullied into changing their vote, which, by the way, not likely to happen. That's not how this works, and this is not how this process is intended to work. To facilitate the demonstration, the website says not only did they post maps and addresses, street addresses, for six Supreme Court justices, but they also announced that they want to see protests inside specifically Catholic churches this coming Mother's Day, so be aware of that as well. The website notes that, quote, stipends are available for protesters, so they're willing to pay people to show up at the homes of Supreme Court justices, and they're willing to pay people to show up at churches this Sunday advocating for abortion rights. You might be wondering who is behind the Ruth Sent Us website. Well, if you go down that rabbit hole, you find links to a series of organizations, one called Strike for Choice. That group then shows connections to Black Lives Matter, Code Pink, Women's March, San Francisco, Kavanaugh Off Our Court, and Rise Up for Abortion Rights. So be aware this is happening in the culture. And yes, peaceful protests are legitimate forms of expression in the United States of America. But inside of churches and outside of the homes of Supreme Court justices are not appropriate places for those kinds of things to take place. And so just be aware of that. Canada has announced that in response to the potential that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to reverse the Roe v. Wade decision, on Tuesday, a Canadian official said that the country to the north of us would be, quote unquote, open. Karina Gould is the Minister of Families, Children, and Social Development in Canada, which makes it interesting that she's now offering international travel to people who want to come and abort their children. She says, I don't see why we would not invite American women to come and have abortions in our country. If people come here and they need access, you know, that service would be provided to them. 25 million unsafe abortions happen every single year. She says criminalizing abortion doesn't mean that those abortions won't happen. What it means is that they will be unsafe abortions. So you are going to hear lots of numbers. You're going to hear lots of statistics. You're going to hear everyone use survey information that comes out on their side of the debate. I don't think it matters what public opinion is. I think it matters what God has said, what human life really is. And then we have to come down on the side of what God has said. And so Bruce Ashford is going to join us next. We're going to talk about seven reasons that the Roe v. Wade decision was bad, seven reasons why abortion is wrong. And we're going to talk about why unborn lives matter. Yeah. Because they're people is going to be the bottom line. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Bruce Ashford is a political speechwriter, a senior fellow at the Kirby Lang Center for Public Theology. He's the author of many books. One of my favorites, Letters to an American Christian. You can follow him on Twitter at Bruce Ashford. Bruce, welcome back.
Carmen, it's great to be on the show this morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you have a couple of pieces posted, one of them at the Daily Signal, seven reasons Roe v. Wade should be overturned. I would love to jump into this. I feel like the equipping that you're doing in terms of preparing us to engage in substantive conversation around the topic of abortion. We may know that we are pro-life from conception to natural death, but we are suddenly in the midst of a national conversation where we want some helpful talking points. So thank you for the way you have addressed these concerns in these articles online. What are some of the reasons that Roe v. Wade should be overturned? Like, why is abortion wrong?
Yeah, so for my friends out there in radio land, you know, a lot of times, rightly so, when we're asked why we're pro-life, we give scriptural reasoning, biblical reasoning. But there's also another kind of reasoning that we can give in the public square that's more neutral, that appeals to people who don't believe what we believe, who don't believe in the Bible. And these are medical, legal, and sociological reasons. And there are a number of those. I mean, there's a cornucopia of them. And so I've listed a few today. The first is that abortion harms the baby. It harms the baby by killing the baby. And we can talk about this later if we have time. But there are four views of what the unborn being is inside of a woman's body. And the Christian view is that unborn being is a human person. And it kills the baby. And we now know, because of medical advances, that the small unborn being experiences excruciating pain during an abortion. People tend to know that, right? And there's even studies that show that almost everybody, even pro-abortion people, know this as a human being. But what we sometimes don't realize is that abortion is an anti-woman. Abortion is abusive to women. What the legalization of abortion, and especially abortion on demand, does is it communicates to women that it's morally acceptable to take the life of their baby, so it hurts them spiritually. And then second of all, it catalyzes male irresponsibility and predatory sexual behavior. Now, if there's one thing men don't need to be encouraged in, it's predatory sexual behavior and sexual irresponsibility, right? Look at it historically. Do men need a little pat on the back there? Probably not. So abortion is bad for women. It's bad for men. Men have absolutely no legal rights when it comes to a baby that they helped to create in making a decision whether or not that baby should live. Abortion harms marriages and families because it teaches families. Now listen to this. If you're in radio land, listen. When a mother has an abortion, or when parents explain to their children why they're pro-choice, the implicit message here is that if we encounter a problem big enough in our life that's a big enough of an obstacle to us, or we encounter a person that is a big enough obstacle, that it is okay morally to use lethal force to solve our problem. And I think this use of lethal force against human beings who are the most vulnerable has something to do with the rise in violent crime in the United States. Fifth, abortion undermines law-governed democracy. It undermines justice and equality. Now listen carefully here. Think about this. In the 60s, you may not have been alive in the 60s if you're listening to the show, or you may have, but in the 60s, we had the civil rights movement. And this is a time when most people in America came to realize that, listen, we can't take an entire category of people, which at the time was black and brown people, black and brown Americans, can't take an entire category of people and just decide that justice and equality for all does not apply to them. But less than a decade later, in 1973, you had some men in little black nightgowns in the Supreme Court who decided that there is, in fact, an entire class of people who don't get justice and equality, and that's unborn beings. And then the last 2 points are Roe v. Wade undermined our nation's system of checks and balances. Our founding fathers determined that the Constitution might need to be changed in the future, and if so, there was a process for doing that, and that's through the legislature, which means through the citizens, to make a legislative change to the Constitution. We call that an amendment. But these judges decided they didn't want to wait for an amendment. They wanted to make their own decision. And so instead of swimming their own lane and interpreting the law, they decided to do what the legislature does and amend the Constitution. Final point is that abortion minimizes society's mediating institutions. It asserts government control over something that government has no right to control. And so in summary, I want to quote Harvard Law professor Mary Ann Glendon, a woman who understands that abortion is not good for women. And she said something like this, that Roe v. Wade caused something like an environmental disaster on the moral ecology of our nation. And there have been two environmental disasters on the moral ecology of our nation, slavery and Roe v. Wade, the institution of slavery and the institution of abortion on demand. And those two environmental disasters are very similar to one another in that they take an entire class of people, black and brown people in one instance, and unborn beings in another instance, and deny justice and equality. So those are the seven.
Yeah, Bruce, that's really helpful. Let's pause there. Let's take a break. And then when we come back, I'd love for you to talk with us about why abortion really has nothing to do with women's rights. We hear all kinds of arguments made to support the view that Roe v. Wade protects women. But you outline that that's an errant perspective. And you talk about, what an unborn human being, well, you talk about what's going on in the womb and, help us understand that that's a real human being. So when we come back, can we talk about that?
Let's do it. I look forward to it.
Fantastic. We're talking to talking with Bruce Ashford. You can find what we're talking about. Both of these articles are posted at Daily Caller. One's posted at dailysignal.com. That's the 7 reasons Roe v. Wade should be overturned. We're going to turn now to a dailycaller.com piece by Bruce, why these unborn lives matter. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
God is on the move.
Continuing our conversation with Dr. Bruce Ashford, you can find Bruce on Twitter at Bruce Ashford. Bruce, let's turn to your piece at dailycaller.com. I thought this was really, really helpful to understand the errant arguments involved in terms of what that exactly is inside a woman's womb, and then obviously establish for us the Christian worldview on the same topic.
Yeah, so if you're out there listening to Radio Land, we're talking about how to make conversation with somebody who has a different view than you do. And sometimes you use scriptural lines of reasoning, but sometimes we can use medical and scientific and sociological lines of reasoning. And when we focus on what the unborn being is inside of the womb, you know, historically, you know, there's no evidence that anybody in the world ever has viewed the being inside of the womb as anything other than a human being, a human person. And yet all of a sudden in the 1970s, you have a different view. And so it's clear that since people wanted abortion to happen, and probably because they wanted to kill black and brown babies, so that there wouldn't be black and brown voters and too much of a gain in our black and brown population, you have to go back and you have to redefine what's in the womb. So one bad approach says that the unborn being is a part of the woman's body. You hear this a lot in contemporary discourse. You hear it a lot by political activists, that a woman controls her own body. Well, certainly she controls her own body. The problem is the unborn being is not a part of the woman's body. It's housed, he or she is housed in the woman's body. But, you know, the unborn being has its own DNA. The baby has his or her own DNA. So an unborn being is not like a woman's toenails that she has control over, and she can clip them if she wants to, or she can let them grow out, you know, 1 or 2 inches long and then use a, you know, a hedge trimmer to trim them. You know, the unborn being is a unique human life. So a second approach, which is made famous by a woman named Judith Jarvis Thompson, is the unborn being is a parasite, because the unborn being can't live unless it feeds off of the host, which is the mother. But, you know, a baby's not a parasite because the baby was designed to live off of the mother and will eventually, very quickly, in the scheme of things, become able to feed itself. And one of the ways of combating this view is that if it's true that an unborn being is a parasite, then so is a 3-month-old infant or a 6-month-old infant, still feeding off the mother's body. And not many people would argue that it's okay to take an infant back to the doctor to have it terminated at 3 months or 6 months. Now, a third approach is the approach, unfortunately, that Roe v. Wade took, and that is that the unborn being is the woman's property, okay? And I think, it's fairly easy for us to say, listen, we agreed in the 1960s, if not before, that it's not okay to view other people as our property. That was the overthrowing of the institution of slavery. That was the point made with the civil rights movement. And the baby is not property. And so what is the baby? The baby, he or she, he or she is a human person. And I don't think there's a lot of arguing we need to do here. The unborn being has its own DNA. It's a human being. It's not a little baby horse or a little baby platypus. You know, it's not property. It's not a parasite. It's not a part. He or she is a human being. So that's, you know, that's sort of how we can reason with people who are defining the unborn being in an inappropriate or incorrect manner.
Yeah, and I think that, Bruce, what you're helping us do is get to a place in the conversation where we can actually talk with someone else about what it means to be human. And that is, I think, ultimately where we have to arrive in this conversation. What does it mean to be human, and where do I get my ideas about what it means to be human? And ultimately, then, this is a theological conversation. I mean, I believe that people are created on purpose and for a purpose by God, as his image bearers, that we are the imago Dei. We are the image bearers of the living God, and every person, regardless of the circumstances of their conception, regardless of their nation of origin, regardless of the socioeconomic or political system under which they're born. Like, we are each and every one uniquely human. And I'm not going to, I am not going to assert my autonomy or my authority over the life of another human being, because that's the purview of God alone. And so ultimately, this is a theological conversation with others, with ourselves, and then with others, you know, about where do I understand myself in relationship to God? How do I understand myself as a human being in relationship to God? And how do I understand every other human being in relationship to God? And who has the authority over life and death? Until we get to that place in the conversation, we are just talking about, you know, asserting some sense of autonomous rights. And I've heard the word autonomy used so many times in the last couple of days. I've lost track of the number of times that language is used openly now in the culture. And when we begin to imagine that we are autonomous, that we are not people who live as creatures under the authority of a creator, we have clearly lost the narrative of human history. And so I think that, you know, we're having big conversations about big things because there's a big struggle going on in our culture right now.
Yeah. You know, one last comment. Do we got a minute?
Well, we can take a minute because, you know, it's my show. Go right ahead.
There was a study published about 15 years ago, Institute of Religion and Public Life, on Religion and Public Life, wrote a couple of articles about it that showed that women who had abortions almost universally know and will articulate, yes, I know the unborn being is human life. And the question in their mind is that if they were to have this unwanted baby, the question isn't whether or not, you know, somebody's going to lose their life. The question is, who's going to lose their life? Is the baby going to lose its life through an abortion, or is the mother going to lose her life as she had imagined it by having an unwanted pregnancy? And so a lot of times on the person-to-person level, the trick is not convincing a woman that the being inside of her body is human. I mean, anyone, man or woman, intuitively knows that. It's showing them, listen, your life is not over if you carry to birth this unborn being that you hadn't planned on. Your life is just beginning. And so that's going to be the challenge often for us. It's not what we see in the news outlets. It's not what we see with the political activists. On the person-to-person level, it's on loving a person and helping them to live their life in conformity with God's good norms for their flourishing.
So helpful. All right, that's Bruce Ashford. You should check out what he's writing, BruceAshford.net. Don't forget the Job series. It's just fantastic. And all the links for today, BruceAshford.net. Bruce, as always, thank you so much.
Great to be on the show, Carmen. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let's catch up quickly with Max Lucado. All right. I know we're a little over time, so I'm just going to quickly tell you that next up we got Dan DeWitt. We are going to look at what's on the Weekend Worldview Reader, and we're going to talk about a journey through death for the living. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. That means Dan DeWitt is with us from Cedarville University. You can find what we're talking about at theolatte.com. Dan, good morning.
Good morning, Carmen. How are you doing?
I am well. Hey, I missed an opportunity to get Bruce Ashford's shout out to his mom for Mother's Day, so I don't want to miss that opportunity with you. You want to give a shout out to your mom and the mother of your children?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So my mom is just a wonderful, godly woman who grew up in an Italian Catholic family in northern Michigan and came to faith at the age of 17 in her log cabin that she lived in with her family. Her and my Aunt Mickey turned on the television set and saw a Billy Graham crusade. And in watching that, she came to faith and has pointed me to that faith over the years. I could not be more thankful for my mom. And then, my goodness, I married so far over my head. It's unbelievable. My wife, April, is just a great mother to our children. So happy Mother's Day to everybody listening. And for me personally, to my mom and to my wife.
Thank you. I can hear the smile in your voice. I just so appreciate that. So so thank you. So you turned me on to something that is happening in a Canadian church, a euthanasia crossover service. I will confess I had never heard of such a thing. So want to encourage folks to check out this article, A Journey Through Death for the Living, at theolatte.com. Dan, what's going on here?
Well, over the weekend, you've not heard about it before because this is new. This is revolutionary that in a church you would have a medically assisted death. And so over the weekend, I saw news about it just on social media as Christian leaders were decrying the news of this church in Canada that hosted this euthanasia ceremony. So they called a crossover service, and they, you know, set up a very peaceful kind of situation in their church. And it's described as feeling a lot like someone's living room. You know, they brought furniture, familiar pictures, family members were there. And then, you know, there was medical assistance for this individual to end their life. And so I think it's going to be important and interesting as we watch Christian leaders respond to this. What is the best way to think about issues like this? And the answers aren't always as crystal clear as we might wish. So in the past, for example, Christian ethicists have made distinctions, like seeing the presence of the soul somehow linked to brain activity of the person. And in such situations, if someone's brain dead, then it could be ethical for someone, you know, to stop the kind of the medical support of one's body. So that kind of careful, ethical Christian reasoning is important and imperative. But these are the kind of issues that we need our brothers and sisters who think deeply about them to help instruct us. So with the news of that story on my mind, I walked into my office on Monday, and I had a folded up copy of the Wall Street Journal from like a week ago. And it was laid out with the story, A Journey Through Death for the Living. And in short, the article's about, really, in many ways, Dante, the Italian poet, and how he really took an active role in shaping the way we think about death, and more importantly, pointing us to life, pointing us to the fact that we'll all stand before God's judgment. So I think for every Christian, we need to think carefully about these issues and also remember that we have a real opportunity. Every person fears death. It's on our mind regularly, and so the Christian is in the opportunity to point people to answers to the deepest questions we have about what comes after we breathe our last breath.
So one of the things in this conversation about this church in Canada and this choice mm-hmm. that they made as a congregation, or at least the leadership of the congregation, to grant this person's wish, like, that's part of what feels like is going on here. Who's guiding and directing this process and this decision making, when this individual decided that she would like to access Canadian, access Canada's euthanasia law, and yeah. And get medical assistance in death, she wanted that to happen in church, in her church, mm-hmm. and part of what I think we have to think through is, who gets to decide what happens in the context of a church? I mean, I'm thinking that if you have arrived at the place where you're in your church decision-making, you're going to host people's deaths. You're going to have these death ceremonies, these crossing over, these quote unquote crossing over ceremonies. You have departed a long way from what the church is about, from what the church is called to be and do in the world. Can you talk about that or reflect on that with me for a moment?
Yeah, I think that's that. It, of course, is an important question. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier on the show, Canada has, in many ways, what we see happening in Canada is going to be perhaps to the left of where we're currently at in the U.S., even their current invitation and plans to make available abortion for people in North America who might lack access to it. So in seeing this story, this is the kind of thing we might think, well, at least we're not facing that currently in the States, but we will. And so I think that Christian leaders need to, again, think very carefully and deeply about this. Should the church have a role in the active ending of someone's life? And of course, there's a distinction between the active ending of one's life and perhaps a more passive form of just failing to give, you know, if someone is brain dead, essentially shutting off the life support for one's body with a belief that their soul is now with God. And so I think it's important for churches to think about if a church is being mandated. In this case, it doesn't seem to be the case that the church willingly participated in this. But the question would be, is there going to be a time at which the church no longer would have a choice in the matter? And then beneath that, is it right for a church to do such things? And what I want to do is to say as Christians, before we immediately rush in with kind of anger over this happening, I'm not saying we shouldn't be angry, to recognize behind this is the story of a family wrestling with a loved one with a terminal disease. We can at least be empathetic of their desire for that person to pass in a way that's connected to their deeply held beliefs. So before we talk about the rightness or wrongness of the event, to recognize this is a real human condition. We're all facing death, and Christians are the ones who have something to offer. Whether or not it should happen in the church, I wouldn't be comfortable if my church did that. That's certainly something every church leader is going to have to think deeply about.
Yeah, I can promise you most churches have not thought through this. I mean, they may have thought through the question of medically assisted suicide, but I guarantee you they haven't thought through whether or not they would host it in the context of something happening in their sanctuary where the person is medically treated to the point of death in the context of the sanctuary. I understand. I mean, I am with you in terms of the recognition of the real human condition and the struggle of a real human family and the struggle of an individual and the desire for, you know, the family of faith to be supportive. I am empathetic to all of those things. I also, if I'm going to be pro-life from conception to natural death, then I'm going to have to be pro-life on this point and have to say that, that this is not, that it's not an appropriate decision. And there's, at some level, there ought to be some spiritual counsel, oversight. Like, is there no spiritual authority left? I mean, I guess maybe that's my question. Is there a spiritual authority in the church to guide families in this, in these conversations? Maybe that's the better question.
And there certainly should be. I remember in seminary, and these are the kind of things that, you know, seminary doesn't always prepare you for, right? These really complicated issues that are not just in the headlines, but in the case of this particular church, it's a couple probably sitting in a minister's office saying, this is something we'd like to do. But I remember a friend of mine, he and his wife discovered that their child, she was pregnant, their child did not have a brain. And the doctor wanted to immediately have the baby aborted, and they had to wrestle with, you know, how should we think about this? And, you know, in that case, it's not a textbook kind of case study. It's real people. And that doesn't mean Christians don't have answers, but our theology is going to be tested in real life. And this story is a reminder of that. But I point out in the story that Dante, who the article, A Journey Through Death for the Living, is about Dante and his The Divine Comedy, that there's a statue made of Dante that a lot of people don't realize. It's the thinking man statue. A lot of people think of him as an icon of secular philosophy. I'm reminded that that statue is actually supposed to be Dante reflecting on the eternal fate of humans. And so I would encourage people listening today, you'll see that image all over the place. When you see it, stop and think for a moment, how am I helping to direct people to think deeply about the reality that one day they'll stand before God?
Yeah, that's so helpful. When we think of ourselves walking through the valley of the shadow of death, we think of doing it, you know, with the counsel of Jesus as the good shepherd. But for any of us who have walked with an individual or a family into the valley of the shadow of death with their beloved, we have then walked with them back out of it. And I think that's the conversation you're trying to provoke. And so, thank you so much for including this, not only these articles, but this reflection, at theolatte.com, A Journey Through Death for the Living. Again, you'll find it at theolatte.com. We're going to continue our conversation with Dan DeWitt in just a moment. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I know there's going to be some brighter days. I swear that love will find you in your pain. We're continuing our conversation with Dan DeWitt from Cedarville University. Dan, it's not lost on me that graduation ceremonies at your university are tomorrow at 10
right.
and 2. I looked it up. Maybe some words of encouragement to those who will be graduating tomorrow or in an upcoming ceremony somewhere else. Maybe some encouragements toward lifelong discipleship.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember years ago I was in high school, but the quote has stuck with me through the years. A commencement speaker at a ceremony I went to before I was graduating, a commencement speaker gave this quote: "Life is like a coin. You could spend it any way you want, but you can only spend it once." And I that quote has stuck with me because it's a reminder that as great as a day like graduation is, it's setting you up for a life of impact. And you only get one chance. You only get one shot at it. As we were just talking about death, you know, we should live with the end in mind, that we get one shot at it. So spend it well, spend it wisely, celebrate the day. This is a great accomplishment. But fix your eyes on Jesus and run the race that he's uniquely set out for you. So congratulations if you're a graduate. Enjoy the day, and then just make this a great time for you before God at some point to say, God, I want to spend this one life you've given me. I want to spend it well. I want to not only spend it, I want to invest it in something that will outlive me in God's work on earth.
That's so good. Thank you. All right. Now, turning back to what you have posted at theolatte.com, I'm looking at a piece entitled, If You Can't Silence That Sad Song, Make It a Duet. I feel like this is an encouragement in the, you know, in the reality of the challenges of mental health that many people are facing today.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I think that often, you know, times that it seems externally like we should be happy are times that a lot of people suffer, you know, whether it's the holidays or in this case, it's spring, you know, we could get out and there's the flowers are in bloom, which those of us with really bad allergies are, you know, it's kind of a bittersweet reality. But these are oftentimes people are suffering on the inside because they feel like they have to live up to this expectation of just being happy. And so I watched a documentary about Fred Rogers a while back, and there was a scene that really affected me. It was talking about how he had written a song for Daniel the Tiger, his character, and it's a sad song. And as he was thinking about the song, he writes out all the lyrics of Daniel singing, and it is indeed just sad. And he wanted to let people see, and let children see in this case, that sometimes that's how life feels. That's simply how life is. Instead of having Daniel at some point make a transition from being sad to not being sad, he decided to just add the voice of another character to it. And for me, in hearing him describe that, I thought, you know, there's something powerful there, that sometimes it's not just, hey, don't sing that sad song, but rather make it a duet. And so if I could sing just, or not sing, sorry, I will not sing, Carmen. You would never have me back on the program. But
why
if
don't
I could
you read the, why don't you read the Daniel Striped Tiger part, and then I will read the second voice.
Okay, great. So I'll kick us off then. Sometimes I wonder if I'm a mistake. I'm not like anyone else I know when I'm asleep or even awake. Sometimes I get to dreaming that I'm just a fake. I'm not like anyone else. Others I know are big and are wild. I'm very small and quite tame. Most of the time I'm weak, and I'm mild. Do you suppose that's a shame? Often I wonder if I'm a mistake. I'm not supposed to be scared, am I? Sometimes I cry and sometimes I shake, wondering, isn't it true that the strong never break? I'm not like anyone else I know. I'm not like anyone else.
I think you are just fine as you are. I really must tell you, I do like the person that you are becoming. When you are sleeping, when you are waking, you are my friend. It's really true. I like you. Crying or shaking or dreaming or breaking, there's no one mistaking it. You're my best friend. I think you are just fine as you are. I really must tell you, I do like the person that you are becoming. When you are sleeping, when you are waking, you're not a fake. You're no mistake. You are my friend.
Isn't that delightful? And I love how Fred Rogers put that together. Here's the sad song, and sometimes it's just adding the voice of a friend who reassures you, who's not scolding you for being sad, but coming alongside you. And so my encouragement to anybody listening today, if you're feeling this kind of sadness, if you can't silence that sad song in your heart, at least make it a duet. Don't sing it alone. Add the voice of God in the scriptures, and then add the voice of a dear friend like Carmen.
So I will say, Dan, that this is one of the things I have learned from children who have some challenges in terms of the way they process sensory input. So I'm thinking here about my my granddaughter who is, who is autistic. You can't tell her not to cry, or you can't tell her to stop. That doesn't work. But if you enter in, if she's crying and you cry with her, she awakens to your presence. Like, it is extraordinary. And so I think part of this is the empathy required to enter into the reality of another person, in order that they can recognize that in that space, they are not alone. And there is there's something very good and very godly about that. It invites us to be incarnational in the spirit of Christ on behalf of another person. And so it's very, very sweet. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. We all need that reminder. And if I could just read the final words of the article, because I wrote it with some specific people in mind and even for myself, that you're not alone. And I wrote this: there's another melody that's purer and even better and better in every conceivable way singing over you. It will win out in the end. It will drown out every sorrow and every lie. And one day we will all join in together in a great chorus, singing along to a tune that's more powerful and more beautiful than anything we've ever heard. Like the psalmist, we will declare, "He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. And many will see it and fear the Lord and put their trust in him."
Amen. All right. You can read this entire article and so much more at theolatte.com. The specific piece we've been discussing is entitled, "If You Can't Silence That Sad Song, Make It a Duet." Dan, as always, thank you so much. And happy Mother's Day to April and to your mom.
Thank you so much, Carmen. Have a wonderful day. God bless.
You too. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back.
He put that hunger in your heart.
Indeed, his love is the reason. We've had a lot of heavy conversations this morning about life and about death. In life and in death, we belong to God. Let me just remind you of that today. All right, briefly here, let me offer up the Friday Farm Report. This is disturbing information and news, and I'm seeking the counsel of wise advisors. So I woke up at about 2 a.m. sensing that there was something present in the room that shouldn't be there. And it's a bat. There's a bat in the bedroom. It's currently like tucked up in the corner behind the louvers of the window blind. And some of you are saying, well, you know, surely your husband, Jim, can take care of that. Yes, but I'm at my parents' house right now because I'm wishing my mom a happy Mother's Day and picking up my niece from college today and taking her to the airport. So I'm a guest in someone else's house, and there's a bat in the bedroom where I slept last night. So looking for your counsel, you can text me what to do at 877-933-2484. All input is appreciated. And let me just tell you, when your adrenaline gets pumping like that at 2 in the morning, yeah, whew, that is some wakiness. All right, we got another hour of Mornings with Carmen up next.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.